America is founded on the belief in the sacredness of private property. But at what cost? And whose property is sacred and whose not?
It would seem that the habit of changing place, of turning things upside down, of cutting, of destroying, has become a necessity of the American's existence. Alexis de Tocqueville, 1831. And that is, I think, goes right to the heart of our attitude towards land and what we think land and property is for and how we've developed the country.
That's Howard Mansfield. We spend the hour with him, first talking about his new book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down. Then we re-air our 2013 interview with him about his book, Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. In America, private property is supposed to be sacred. But whose private property is sacred? Is the land of ranchers and farmers on the U.S. southern border sacred when Donald Trump wants it to build his wall on? Is the land of West Virginians and Pennsylvanians sacred when gas companies take it to drill and frack gas? Or how about people in New Hampshire and Massachusetts when oil and gas companies take it for their pipelines? While reporting on citizens fighting natural gas pipelines and transmission towers planned to cut right across their homes, author Howard Mansfield saw the emotional toll of these projects. This was about more than kilowatts, power lines, and pipelines, he writes. Something in this upheaval felt familiar. I began to realize that I was witnessing an essential American experience. The world turned upside down. And it all turned on one word, property. His new book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down, tells the stories of Americans living in a time in which everything is in motion, in which the world will be turned upside down again and again. Howard Mansfield is the author of numerous books, including Dwelling in Possibility and In the Memory House. He's married to the celebrated science writer Cy Montgomery and lives with her in New Hampshire. The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down is out from Bowen Press. Well, Howard Mansfield, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you very much. It's good to be here.
I found this book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down, as a book that I have been looking for to be written for many years. So I am so glad that you wrote it. I think it's about a very important subject. But before we get to the subject, I'm going to ask you, why the habit of turning the world upside down?
Well, it's the way we regard the world. It's the way we treat land. It's the way we regard property. And it comes from something Alexis de Tocqueville said. You know, de Tocqueville wrote the famous book, Democracy in America. And he came here in 1831. It was a young country. De Tocqueville's a young man. He's an aristocrat. He's like 26 or 27. He's running around interviewing all sorts of Americans. And he makes this note in his journals after talking with one American diplomat. And de Tocqueville says this: "It would seem that the habit of changing place, of turning things upside down, of cutting, of destroying, has become a necessity of the American's existence." Alexis de Tocqueville, 1831. And that is, I think, goes right to the heart of our attitude towards land and what we think land and property is for and how we've developed the country.
You say that property is our pyramids and our Parthenon. What do you mean by that?
It's our great creation. I think you have to understand how property in America is different and how it changed from what property was before in the feudal ages. In feudalism, if your family had property, had land, you couldn't sell it. Land was the family. And you had all these obligations by all these terms that are now lost to us, escussage, burgage, francomelion, knight service, so forth, types of cultures, corridy, so forth. And then when it came to America, all that was thrown out, and property became a commodity. In fact, there's a famous legal historian who said, American law favors property in motion, or at risk, rather than property secure and at rest. And that's the American system. The American system is a sign in a lot by the road that says 1 acre zone commercial will build to suit. And the great historian of the Revolution, Gordon S. Wood, he said this: indeed, the great change that Americans made in their understanding of property can explain the American Revolution. It's like, whoa. So it was that fundamental a change. And that around us is so invisible. I say in the book, it's like property is the air we breathe. All those assumptions about property we never think about. And so it affects not only how we think about the world, but even what we even let ourselves think about. It defines everything. It's, in fact, our boundaries.
You know, it's so interesting because you take something that we just take for granted and show that it's really something that is very particular to a time and a place in history, in the founding of America, and now, you know, has in many ways taken over the world. This country was supposed to be founded on the sacredness of private property, which is, you know, something that you talk about, but this book really asks, whose private property is sacred?
Well, it's exactly that way from the start. If you're obviously a white male and have property, you can vote. So you have property rights. But the Indians, the Native Americans who they encountered, were not thought of as having property rights. In fact, the Puritan John Winthrop says in 1628, you know, the Indians, you know, they have no settled habitation, neither do they cultivate the land or have any tame cattle. So therefore, in his view, they were not following the injunction, I think it's in Genesis 1:28, which is, you know, to have a dominion over the land and all the animals. So therefore, they had no property and no property rights. And then the Supreme Court comes along in 1823 and defines the Indians off the land. The Supreme Court says, you know, the Indians only have a quote-unquote right of occupancy. They're only tenants at will. On this land, they've been here for a millennia, you know. So in effect, we are the landlords and they're the tenants. And that is the attitude that prevails.
And the book is about the belief in property and the cost of that belief. And I think what's so important as one goes through the book is to realize how this dispossession of the Indians of really the use of the land that they had inhabited for millennia now has begun to apply to all of us in many ways. Not all of us, but many of us, maybe most. You begin the book with a farmer in New Hampshire telling you what's happening to his land. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I'm in far north New Hampshire where you can look for miles and see mountains and mountains and mountains, and then you're looking into Canada. It's right at the top, the North Country. And there's this big project called Northern Pass, in which Hydro-Quebec, which is the largest power utility in all of North America, they flooded an area the size of Germany up in Quebec to make hydropower, has a lot of this and wants to bring it down to Massachusetts and other busy cities. Well, okay. But to do that, they want to bring these large transmission towers, like 14 stories tall, over the land right through this farmer's land. And he says, no, wait a minute. No, you know, this land is who we are. They all keep offering him money. In fact, they offer him $4 million. And he says, no, not interested. My roots are deeper than your pockets. And what you have there is, in effect, once again, the farmer there is in the position of the Indians. He's now all of a sudden a tenant at will. He has to show why his pursuit of happiness should interfere with property in motion. And in fact, there's another thing that's said in American law, and this comes from an 1895 legal textbook, which it says, the quiet citizen must keep out of the way of the exuberantly active one. In other words, if you're happy on your land, you know, milking your cows or doing whatever you're doing, you have to make way for somebody with plans who has a railroad, a highway, a big project to go through. And all of a sudden, the burden of proof is on you to show why that project is not justifiable, instead of the other way around. And I saw this over and over again when I'd be meeting with people. And it was that kind of pain, that kind of tumult, that made me realize that whatever I was reporting on, whether it was the Northern Pass power lines or the big Kinder Morgan frack gas pipeline that was trying to come through Massachusetts, that this was about more than natural gas or kilowatts and power. It was about a fundamental American perception of property.
Well, that fundamental American perception of property started out with the ideal of the yeoman farmer, exactly somebody like your farmer in the North Country of New Hampshire. What made that change? In other words, who gets to define what is the proper use?
And well, that's exactly the question. Who gets to define? Who gets to decide? And that is what is being contested now by a lot of people. There's, the entire country is going through kind of an upheaval in that there are very large projects, almost even as the country deindustrializes, there's these large sort of industrial-scale projects suddenly being plopped down next to people's rural settings, whether it's these pipelines that have these enormous gas compression stations or some of these windmill farms, of which are enormous scale. And that question of who gets to decide comes right up. But when you go back and look through the law as it developed, particularly in the 19th century, to aid development of railroads and canals and then later highways, you see that it has always favored development, and development has had the right of way. Now, that had created a great deal of wealth for the community, but where that wealth ended up in the community was never an issue in the law. It was never considered. So what you had often is individuals who might property be destroyed by the railroad coming through, and they're told, well, look, it's going to be really good for the whole community. So what happens is an individual ends up, against their will, subsidizing that project. And that's sort of that kind of inequality has continued on to this day.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with author Howard Mansfield about his book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down. It's about how American society treats property rights and who pays the price. You know, it's interesting. You mention, you talk about oil and gas pipelines on the one hand. You also, as you just mentioned, windmills. What do we do in a situation where if we want to, you know, keep using electricity, we're going to have huge industrial installations of wind energy in order to save this farmer and every other farmer and possibly every human being and living being on the planet from catastrophic climate change? So, you know, is there a place where the community benefit does outweigh the individual benefit? How do we balance those rights?
Yeah, and that's the question. And it's really tough, and it's really going to be painful, and I think we're ahead for a lot more pain. I think one of the things to realize, just since I mentioned windmills, is that we don't really understand how industrial a complex they are. You know, it just sounds benign because it's wind. And if you go back, since I had mentioned railroads before, when railroads first started being built in the 19th century, they're being put everywhere until finally people realized what a big industrial kind of setting this was and got that sorted out. So these windmills have to find their place on the landscape, and we have to realize what is the total cost of this kilowatt if we're going to, you know, blast all these roads for access to these things and destroy ridge lines and destroy views. Are there other ways to do this? And there always are, but by the time these things come up, those things have never been in the picture to start with.
Yeah, you talk also about the pipeline fight, and I know about this fight because I lived in Western Massachusetts for many, many years, and just before I left, it started heating up. This is the Kinder Morgan pipeline that came through upstate New York and then was supposed to go through Canada and right into your area in New Hampshire as well. Tell us about Lynn Placy and the fight against Kinder Morgan.
Yeah, okay, yeah, the Lynn Placy, she's actually up in the North Country, and she was a piano teacher who was fighting Northern Pass, the power lines. And Lynn, she's a 65-year-old widow with, you know, not much money, and she has like 40 or 50 piano students, and that's it for her income other than, you know, Social Security. And again, the Northern Pass Consortium, Hydro-Quebec, and Eversource in New Hampshire came and offered her a lot of money, and she said, nope, not going to sell anything. My allegiance is to this land for my children. My allegiance is to the North Country. My allegiance is to values that are more eternal than what you're after, and there are other ways to do this. And she became a huge hero up there, a huge hero for making her stand. She even had to raise money just to have her land surveyed because one of her nephews was selling his land, you know, that kind of thing. But she made a huge stand.
Well, that's right. So Lynn Placy was up there. But tell us about the Kinder Morgan, because that is a fascinating case of a company that came in and said, hey, basically, if you want electricity, if you want, you know, we need to be able to deal with peak demand. And I have to tell you, right here in Eastern Long Island, we're dealing with the same thing. When the utility wants to build a $750 million transmission line that's going to get its energy from dirty energy in order to meet something like three summer days of peak demand that out here on the east end of Long Island with all these millionaire and billionaire homes. And, you know, the community is saying, can't we avoid this by decreasing demand?
So, and there are, there are, when you get into it, there are all sorts of ways that are seldom pursued by power companies to shave peak demand with this thing they call the duck curve or something, the curve that's supposed to be shaped like a duck, and it's that little bit of extra demand. And there are a lot of different ways to go about that they should pursue before they come in with a big project like that. But they're just kind of, their mindset is to go right in for the big project. So the Kinder Morgan pipeline, the assumptions there were greatly flawed. They just showed up in towns knocking on doors. In fact, there's one fellow, Vince Primus, he's going out one morning to go to work, and there's a guy in his driveway with a map and a bunch of papers. Oh, you know, by the way, this pipeline's going to come through 200 feet from your door. Sign here, sign here, sign here. And that's it. That's the first he ever heard of it. And this happened all over the place, town after town. What he did, what everyone did, is they quickly organized. They learned about the ins and outs of this energy policy. They learned who decided. They testified. They spoke to their representatives everywhere. They marched, and they won the day. It's a good example of how they were really model citizens, but basically their lives became like the pipeline for 2 years. I mean, they had just took over their lives, a lot of people. It's just a tremendous stress.
Well, they won the day, but at first they won the day by having the Kinder Morgan pipeline route being announced elsewhere.
Yeah, which wasn't their intent. It was just sort of a Kinder Morgan's way of trying to go forward. And then what happened is, even though this pipeline had been south of the New Hampshire border by just, 10, 12 miles, it was complete news to everyone in these towns on the other side of the border, just completely disguised. And the whole process started all over again with people, having up late at their computer learning about, the FERC, which is the board that governs the decision-making and the energy policies and the whole thing. And it just started all over again until Kinder Morgan decided to go away for now.
And why did they decide to go away, do you think?
Well, they said they didn't have enough customers. That's what they said. The reason why they said they were bringing this pipeline in was a shortfall of like some 20-odd days in one winter, and which was really, when you got into it, was really false, because there are all sorts of things going on there about the pipelines not being full, about the way gas was being bought, about all sorts of things to shave peak demand that weren't being done. So their case didn't hold up. So why exactly they went away, I only know the reason they said for the record.
Mm-hmm. So now let's go back to a little bit of the development of the concept of property here. We talked about, how Indians were defined as, occupants but not owners. You took a long walk with the Tohono. How do I pronounce that?
Well, there's a number of pronunciations, but they favor Tohono O'odham. Their reservation, which is at the bottom of Arizona, is actually the size of Connecticut, which is kind of hard to imagine. It's that kind of weird disparity. And I was out there in the desert walking with them for several days on their reservation, from village to village on their reservation. The Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum had organized this desert walk to revive the Tohono O'odham's, to revive their interest in native foods. They have tremendous problems. They have low income rate. They have one of the highest rates of adult onset diabetes because of this change in their diet, so forth and so on. And a lot of this all goes back to where the border is. I'm walking along one day, in the desert, which, as is completely different than northern New England, just as far as what everything looks like and what trees look like and how the desert is formed. And I realized, oh my gosh, I'm walking in the Gadsden Purchase. This is like a schoolboy kind of realization. Now, the Gadsden Purchase was the very last bit of land that was added to the continental United States during the presidency of Franklin Pierce in the 1850s. And it was bought solely to find a route for the Southern Transcontinental Railroad, solely for that. And that's how we learned it. And when we learned it on the map, it's a blank space. And the Americans regarded that, like Kit Carson said, you know, this land couldn't support a wolf. It couldn't support anything, although the Tohono O'odham, the desert people, had a desert agriculture that they had supported themselves for like 10,000 years, growing various beans and hunting small animals. But to them, it's sacred land. It's where their sacred peak is. They have the eldest people still know the stories that they used to sing to find their ways around the land. So all that was kind of coming back. So here you have this classic confrontation in how land is regarded. To us, it's a land deal. It's another blank space on the map. To Tohono O'odham, it was their homeland. It was their sacred land. And when that border was drawn, it completely broke up their native way of life because they used to go south into Mexico to the Sea of Cortez, where there's another group of Indians, the Seri or the Comcoc, and they would intermarry, they would trade, they would go back and forth. And as the border hardened over the years, first for hoof and mouth and for other reasons, they lost that entire contact. And they also lost contact with their native agriculture. So all that is revealed just by looking at maps. And when you look at those old school maps that we had, and they would place like the names of the Sioux or the Pueblo Indians over the maps, you know, you'll notice that the names just kind of float over the top of the maps. It's almost as they don't have land, they don't have territory. It's just almost like clouds moving across the continent. So again, it just reveals our attitude. We tend to see boundaries, and we tend to overlook really the qualities of the land itself that are within that boundaries.
And then you spent some time talking about our first president, George Washington. I mean, talk about high crimes and misdemeanors. He walked right over the laws using every trick in the book.
You know,
tell us about the Dismal Swamp Company, which I think is very appropriately named.
Yeah, you know, everyone has asked me about this. Everyone's like shocked at George Washington. George Washington started out with nothing. I mean, he didn't have corn to feed his horse. He became a surveyor, a very important occupation in the settling of the country. And he knew right off he was in Virginia, and Virginia was a particularly land-hungry empire. And the aristocracy of Virginia was into assembling huge acreages of land and then enslaving people to, you know, farm that land and to develop that land. So Washington knows right off that people are making money by buying the rich back countries, he says. So at a very young age, he buys 2,000 acres of land in the Shenandoah Valley, and he gets his start. And then he goes off, he fights in the French and Indian War, and there are bounty lands awarded to the soldiers in what is now Ohio, in the Ohio Territory. And each soldier is entitled to a certain amount of land. And Washington goes and buys these rights from other people and uses fronts and beards, other people in front, so it's not Washington. Anyway, he ends up with like 30,000 acres. And there was very specific rules about how much riverfront that you could have so everybody could get the river. Washington, you know, small amounts, you know, just a couple hundred acres along a river. And he ends up with like 30 miles of river frontage along one of the key rivers there. And that's just one example. A lot of the settlers would buy something they call preemption rights, which was, even though the Indians are still on their land, they have the right, once the army comes through and moves them out, they're going to buy that land. So he deals in that, too. So he is, you know, a huge landholder, and he was still broke, and a big slaveholder. He did free his slaves upon his death. Martha Washington didn't free her slaves. She actually couldn't under the laws of the time, but she wouldn't have anyway, I don't think, anyhow. So, yeah, he's a representative man in that way. So the Great Dismal Swamp is this huge, I think, 2,000 square mile cypress swamp that right there, it crosses over with North Carolina and Virginia, the border. It's a vast thing. And Washington forms his company with some other people and buys 40,000 acres of swamp to drain the swamp, and he says they're going to farm there. The adventurers for draining the Dismal Swamp. And they never make any money, and they enslave a lot of people, and the slaves die. And it never makes any money during Washington's time. You have these poor slaves digging ditches by hand. And in fact, the oldest Washington monument in the country is this thing called Washington Ditch, which was built to help drain the swamp. Eventually, they build a canal, and they cut these ancient cypresses cypress trees, and they become the shingles that are used on the roofs in Philadelphia, Boston, and New York. So he was totally occupied in this idea of making land. That's what he wanted to do. That's a classic endeavor of the era.
We're talking with author Howard Mansfield about his book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down. This is Writer's Voice. So making land, which is really actually a fiction, it's a legal fiction. It has, you say at one point in this book, that property is legal right to draw a boundary and exclude others, and each boundary severs what was once whole. Each line drawn across the land reorders the world and buries history. Property is made by boundaries, but the earth is a totality.
Yeah, and that's the ecological view. If you have an ecological view, if you understand how things are working, then boundaries are artificial. Boundaries are an artificial way to look at the world. And one of the problems we're having with climate change is that we're very boundary obsessed, and we don't realize the way that everything works in totality. So land and property, in a lot of ways, are sometimes just different things. Property is our way of seeing it, our limited way of seeing it.
And property is now, of course, being extended to more and more things. Colonialism, the history of colonialism, of course, is the history of taking over other people's property. But now you have these huge land grabs all over the world by countries like China. Saudi Arabia is buying up farmland in the United States. I mean, what's going to happen when we have a hugely stressed agriculture due to climate change, and whatever productive capacity of the land is owned by Saudi Arabia, not the U.S.? And you also talk about things like mineral rights, you know, where people can own the property on top of the land, but not underneath the land. So this is just, it seems like a really insane notion that property has run amok in the idea of the definition of what it is.
Well, you know, if that's your reaction, then I think that's great, because I did want people to think, God, this is just very strange. You know, this is, and when you actually start reading the philosophical history of property and why do we have property, and you find out it does. There's no real great justification for it. Either this is God's plan, property was, this is the way the world is, or the property exists because of the state, and the state exists to protect property, but it's all very circular. And so it's a good thing to question, absolutely. And you talked about the mineral rights. We have over 50 eastern national forests that were east of the Mississippi, that were established by the Weeks Act in 1911. Huge piece of legislation. And how that came about was the White Mountains here in New Hampshire, now the White Mountain National Forest, had been logged over so bad that there were tremendous fires and huge runoff. And you look at the old photos of some of these mountainsides, they look like Antietam and Gettysburg after the battle, just totally beat. And what was happening was downriver and down the Merrimack River was flooding from the runoff and shutting down the Amiskeg Mill, the largest mill in cotton mill and a textile mill in the world at the time. So finally, after like 40 congressional votes that they lost over 10 years, these reformers, they found the open sesame, the words to save this land. And it wasn't for forest practices, it wasn't for ecology, it wasn't for recreation, it wasn't for scenery, it was for property. They could save these lands to protect property downstream. They could protect the headwaters just for that reason. So they found the open sesame to create this vast treasure for all of us. But within the national forest, and particularly some of them out in Pennsylvania, near the Marshall, in the shale fields, there are mineral rights that were not bought. And under the law, mineral rights are considered to be dominant. That's the expression. So I can go in, even though you own the land, I can go in and just go right in there and start drilling for my gas or my oil or my mining. So again, even though we have this great achievement, the Weeks Act and National Forests, this astonishing like 50% of land held within National Forests, some of them, are private. So again, you get this great checkerboard and this great back and forth between public good and private wealth.
And tell us what's happening to public lands right now. I mean, it's not just Trump that is doing this, but the process has really accelerated. These are public lands that are supposed to be, I mean, public. They are part of the inheritance of every single person living in the United States.
Well, if you read the news from day to day, as you know, about the Bears Ear National Monument being radically reduced, you about drilling rights being opened up and threatening all sorts of endangered animals, opening up land in the Arctic National Refuge to drill, opening up land off the coast. So there's a rapid, you could call it essentially a land rush, a gold rush, a grab as fast as they can to take what are public lands and sell the rights for nothing and open it up to extraction, which I don't know. I don't think a lot of people voted for that. Out west, they've always complained about how much of federal lands is are owned in their state. But this is really against the public interest.
Mm. Well, Howard Mansfield, this is such an important book, The Habit of Turning the World Upside Down. It's beautifully written as well. Thank you so much for talking with us again on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Howard Mansfield. Stay tuned for another conversation with him, this time about his 2013 book, Dwelling in Possibility. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour today with Howard Mansfield. He writes books grounded in a profound sense of place. They expand the way we see the world around us and consider time, space, landmarks, and architecture. In 2013, we spoke with him about his book, Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Here's a lightly edited version of that interview. What makes a home a place to dwell in, a place that makes us feel happy to be alive? Why do some places invite us in and others feel like soulless boxes? These and many other questions about dwelling are explored by my guest Howard Mansfield in his new book, Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Its chapters explore such different branches of the question as, how does losing electrical power in a storm change us? The meaning of the destruction of homes in war, the house as a stage for reverie, and how communities are seeking to bring back homes that encourage relationships instead of consumerism. Writing about preservation, architecture, and American history, Howard Mansfield has contributed to the New York Times, American Heritage, the Washington Post, Yankee, and other publications. He's also the author of 6 books, including In the Memory House and The Bones of the Earth. I started out our conversation by asking Howard Mansfield to read a passage from Dwelling in Possibility.
I like house hunting. I am fascinated by how houses succeed or fail to shelter us, body and soul. I could go from house to house clear across the country, knock on doors and ask, can I come in? Look around? What's your favorite room? Your latest house project? I'd like to see them all. The sour living rooms behind dirty windows and overgrown shrubs. The small rooms made smaller by dark wood paneling, big fat lazy boy recliners, and the large screen TV. McMansions where rooms and rooms leak space. Prim places where the grass is edged, the shrubs are obedient, and inside the couch is under a plastic cover, and the cabinet of curios is dusted and gleams at attention. Houses where the Bible and the baby Jesus are the only ornaments, and guns lie asleep in drawers and cabinets. Houses that are all noise, as if they are cotton candy spun from the loud, always-on TV and the radio giving traffic reports to the resident who doesn't drive. Houses that smell from the morning's bacon all day long, where one breakfast seems to compound the next, as if staleness were compounded daily like old-fashioned passbook savings accounts. Houses that smell of feet or vaguely like diapers, even though the children are in high school. Houses you covet, so airy, so modest in their grandeur. Houses where everything seems to be right. Husband loves wife. Cat loves dog. Tree loves house. House loves view. Houses that are worn and comfortable like an old fielder's mitt, like the sweatshirt and jeans a commuting executive wears on Saturdays. Houses that are mysterious in their blandness. The rooms of furniture stood out as expected, as prescribed. But you know no one really lives there. Where's the real life? This is a front. You don't want to see, and you do want to see, the private rooms. houses that are walled with photos of children, grandchildren, nieces and grandnieces, the walls of diplomas hanging like battle ribbons. Houses that you pass 100 days, 1,000 days, maybe every day of your life, and no one enters. Even the lawn seems to be self-mowing, the mail self-removing. Houses that command a hill, houses that play hide-and-seek behind trees and shrubs. Houses that seem vulnerable, exposed by a highway exit on a traffic island, backing to a big store parking lot or railroad tracks, the house a goldfish bowl. Houses in which terrible things have happened in daylight. Houses in which nothing has happened, and that seems terrible. Houses where the boredom sticks to the yellows the walls like grease from 10,000 meals. Houses that grow old with their inhabitants, roofs and walls and windows, all flaking, peeling, breaking. The house has arthritis. The house is closed to the world. Houses that spill out toys and bikes and cars and tools and projects, sometimes right to the line of their neighbor's land. Thousands, millions of houses. You drive past them at 1 a.m., 2 a.m. All those people asleep, snoring, dreaming, all in the dark, trusting in the state that no marauders will come in the night.
Yeah, that's just beautiful. And you write, in fact, that the peak of dwelling is poetry. It's a quote from the philosopher Heidegger. But I think you've just shown us the kind of poetry you mean in some ways.
Yeah, it's the poetry of the ordinary, isn't it? It's just it's everyday life. It's the nothing much that is home. It's peace, silence, and dreams. It's clutter. It's the mess on the table or the drawings on the refrigerator wall. It's tumult. It's passing the time with friends. It's the little landmarks of the house, you know, the funny thing your aunt gave you, or the ugly wedding present you can't really part with because it reminds you of somebody, different things that have just been with you forever.
So tell us, what is the soul of shelter? What do you mean when you say that dwelling is a soul of shelter?
Well, dwelling, which is, you know, obviously in the title of the book, Dwelling and Possibility. Dwelling is an old-fashioned word, I think, that we've misplaced. And what I mean by that is when we dwell, we're really present. We're here. We live heart and soul. We are committed to that place. Essentially, we have possession of it, and it has possession of us. And so, therefore, we dwell.
And yet we've been really getting away from dwelling. We build anti-dwellings, you say. What does it say about a culture that builds houses but not homes?
Yeah, it's a big problem, and it's one of these real divisions, is that so many ordinary things that were once just very common in the house have changed in the last 100, 150 years, so that today I think we're crowding ourselves out of our dwellings, out of our houses. We're crowding ourselves out with clutter, which is just a big obsession of the age, and crowding ourselves out with visual clutter, virtual clutter, I mean, so that we're not really there anymore. We kind of just check into the place, and we find it not satisfying. Mm-hmm. And I think that the more it's not satisfying, the more things people tend to accumulate. It's almost like junk food or junk calories, in a sense. You keep trying to compensate for that, so you move to bigger and bigger spaces and fill it up and move on. You know, the extent of that is of just two quick examples of that. At the founding of the country, the average house size was about 700 square feet, which is the size of about a two-car garage, and it was filled with people. Maybe 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 people would be living in that space, and you might have a bowl, a spoon, a table. That would be it. Today, we live in 10 to 14 times the amount of space on average, and it's filled with stuff and few people, maybe 2.3 people on average, and still 1 in 10 families rents a storage shed, and there's more storage sheds in this country than McDonald's now. The Storage Shed Association, the inevitable trade group, says that if every American wanted to, they could shelter under the space of storage shed. So it's a complete reversal. We have things replacing life, stuff replacing life. And the virtual clutter thing is like how much that work has followed people home. And we all have these computers with all these post-it notes on it and all these peripheral things. And the study I saw said that on average now, Americans are spending 8.5 hours a day looking at screens. That's television screens, smartphones, GPS, computers. 8.5 hours a day is a heck of a lot of time.
Yeah, you know, what you're talking about reminds me of something I read, you know, about a million years ago. Marx once said that, Karl Marx, that is, said that capitalism brings about a change, that there were, you know, there used to be material relationships between people, and now there are social relationships between things.
Oh, that's really good. And what else he said? He said, your money can go out and buy the experiences for you.
Right.
He's very early in saying that. So your money, which is, you know, the whole so-called experience economy you hear these consultants talk about now. You know, Starbucks doesn't sell you a coffee, they're selling you an experience. The Rainforest Cafe isn't selling you a hamburger, they're selling you an experience. It's just craziness.
And houses are selling us the experience of dwelling without actually being dwelling in some way, like the McMansions.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think when you get to the shelter magazines and you get to the all these channels, that's what you're seeing. It's like this kind of manifest destiny of home improvement, that you won't be happy unless you have the perfect kitchen, the perfect porch, this new finish, that finish. And, you know, people always say, well, it needs to be updated, which is just kind of a crazy notion that people have married on to.
Right. Well, there are three parts to this wonderful book, Howard Mansfield. The book is called Dwelling in Possibility. There are three parts. One is Dwelling in the Ordinary, which we've just started talking about, Dwelling in Destruction, which is also a fascinating section, and Dwelling in Possibility. Let's go back to the ordinary again. You have a chapter early on about being caught in the ice storm of 2008. Now, that wasn't a very ordinary experience, but it really puts you in the here and now. Your electricity was out for a while. There was an inconvenience, but there was also an upside. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the storm was fierce. I mean, we woke up to the sounds of huge limbs of, you know, 100-year-old and older trees just falling on the house and near the house and crashing down, and not knowing when that would stop. And the place, our part of New Hampshire, looked like a tornado had been through. Wires down, trees tipped over, transformers on the ground. And we were without power ourselves for 6 days in the end of December. And what happened once you got past the terror of everything falling onto your house was that our house, it's not that old a house. It's 1880. We have an old wood stove in part of the house. And so all of a sudden, we began living by the wood stove, the old Vermont Castings wood stove. Back there we were, the old steady Reliant stove, feeding it from the wood pile, living by the light of the fire, looking at the fire, discussing what we didn't know because it was nothing but rumors and no information around. And all of a sudden, the entire house was different. Its pre-electric self emerged. The smell of the house and the wood smoke, the colors of the day were completely different in the house because you didn't have electricity. So as the light faded early in 4:30, 4:30, the light in the house changed, and it was just a different spirit in the house. It was kind of terrific in that way, and everybody was released from their routine, so you'd run into people all over the place, and we had wonderful dinners with our neighbors, you know, around candlelight, everybody just salvaging what they could from when everything was melting and ruining, so you might as well eat it. So it was a little bit of like a week and a half long snow day in which you couldn't get email or anything. But it released us to experience more of the present.
Yeah, and just the light, the quality of the light, the quality of the heat. You know, it used to be the hearth was almost synonymous with the home, and yet we don't have hearths anymore unless they're kind of decorative with a couple of gas logs twinkling merrily.
Exactly, and that is the huge change that kind of came home to me, kind of like an aha moment, but more of like aha duh moment for myself, was that, oh my gosh, for thousands of years, we lived first outside by the campfire. We always lived by a campfire, told stories by a campfire, a whole thing. And then when we moved indoors in the Middle Ages, you always have these tales of these huge halls with these smoky fires and birds flying through and bards declaiming the news and everything. And then someone said, let's put that fire under a hood. And then someone said, let's make a big fireplace. And this took thousands of years to figure out, you know, how to get the smoke out. And then the fireplace became smaller and actually started generating heat. And then the fire got put into a metal box, the wood stove. And then for most of us, the fire, the hearth disappeared, went into the basement. And that hearth central house really was gone. And this was really disorienting. You've read about it in the Beecher Sisters and other people at the sort of towards the end of the 19th century. It was like a whole spirit had gone out of the house. Houses were warmer, but a spirit had gone, that sense of everybody sitting around the fire, of families gathered by the fire, either having great times or getting on each other's nerves, depending on the family. But once the hearth goes out, once the fire goes out, everything is decentralized. Everybody is free with the hearth and central, with the hearth gone, with central heating, with electricity. You don't have to cuddle in one place. Everybody's free to go off to their separate rooms and their own gadgets. And it's life is decentralized. Life is not as central. And you see the same thing happening in cars today. It used to be, you know, when we were growing up, if there'd be like an AM station, everybody would listen to that or play stupid car games on long trips or annoy your brother. Now you drive past cars and these video screens are down and the kids in the back are just each watching their own video screen or everybody's plugged into their own iPod. It's the same kind of thing, you know. The classic American space, I think, is, you know, cabin in the woods. The iPod is a cabin in the woods. You're always kind of recreating that isolation.
So what do you think that means for us as a culture? I mean, we're spinning away from each other in so many ways. How do you see that happen? What are the ramifications of that you see for our society?
Well, I think everybody pretty much knows it's like there's a isolation, that sense that people aren't talking to each other, this sense that we think that the next gadget along is going to kind of recreate this for us. I mean, a survey I saw by an academic said that parents and children spend an average of 14.5 minutes a day talking. That's the total, which I guess if you had a teenager, it would be an epic conversation. But anyway, so we're just more and more isolated from each other in a lot of ways, and everybody can be plugged into whatever they want now, essentially their own channel. You can choose your own facts on the internet if you want. You can download your own music. You can just go your own way. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, very troubling on a lot of levels.
And yet it's touted as a heightened form of connectivity because we can connect with anybody all over the world. What does it mean when we can connect with people far away, but we can't connect with the people right here at home?
Yeah, I mean, we wrestle with that all the time. It used to be that if everybody lived in, say, the same town, everybody was more or less on the same page and knew what's going on. And now it's not true. There are people who know what's going on. There's people you talk to. But there's other people who are plugged into maybe some kind of community around the world or a community that they work in. And it's just different levels and different layers, and it's harder to find the commons. I think it can still be found. We have to sort of work to kind of create that, to find that.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Howard Mansfield about his wonderful book. It's called Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Now, let's go on to dwellings and destruction. I know a little bit about this history because I've done a lot of work on World War II and it's one of my interests. And I don't think a lot of people really know about the firebombing, the incredible devastation of the firebombing that the Allies unleashed on Germany and Japan during World War II. But you actually start the chapter out with Vietnam, burning villages in Vietnam. So let's start there. Morley Safer broke the story. Tell us what that story was.
It might be the most famous couple of minutes of television ever aired. There in the year, it's not like the front of my mind, was it 1965 or 66? Anyway, early in the 60s, Morley Safer just filed this report from CBS News showing American GIs going into a village, lighting huts on fire, and, you know, killing people. And this just caused huge upset in the country. People couldn't believe it. They just denied it. They said either Morley Safer had staged it or given the Zippo lighters to it. And it's still today on the internet. You can go all over and read fierce denials of it as if that one image lost the war. It was just very upsetting to people, as it rightly should be. And it's emblematic of what war is about, which is about destroying your neighbor's house, destroying your neighbor's home, driving your enemy, that person, off the earth. It's just a visceral image, and that's why I think there's such strong denial of it. And it's just a basic level of dwelling, I think.
Well, describe that image a little bit more for us. What was happening? because there were many, many instances of this. You know, what would happen when U.S. soldiers would go to a Vietnamese village and, you know, put their Zippo lighters to the roof thatch? And, you know, what was going on in the village?
See, you see people, women and children huddled together. You see them crying. You see old men there pleading. It's just a visceral confrontation.
Yeah. And that was their entire livelihood was contained in those houses.
That was their house. I mean, it's as if someone came and burned your house down. I mean, there are different kinds of houses, but it's just exactly that.
And all their wealth as well was contained in them. I mean, it's just searing to read. You say that what was on fire there was the old way. It wasn't just that we were burning down the houses of, you know, people who were incredibly poor on the other side of the world, but we were also setting fire to the old way of being.
That's the way it seems to me. There's a great quote by this historian, architectural historian named Reichert. He says, you know, paradise is a promise as well as a memory, and that we always have the hut with us, this memory of this kind of primitive hut. And I think that's one of the reasons why it resonated with people. I mean, in Vietnam, we waged this war against the earth. I mean, burning down forests, poisoning forests with ancient arch, bombing forests. It was just we've turned away from even thinking about that anymore. There's a wonderful historian, a Romanian historian of religion, the sacred, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, Marcia Eliade.
Oh, Mircea Eliade, yes.
Thank you, Mircea Eliade, who says that a dwelling contains the world. It's sacred, and it's a small map of the cosmos. And I think instinctively, when we look at bombed out images of Vietnam or Europe, that's what we're responding to.
Hmm. Well, in Germany too, you know, why did the Allies decide to firebomb the civilian populations of Germany so intensely? And of course, they weren't the ones who started. I mean, the Germans, you know, were the first ones to start that kind of massive bombing of populations. But what we unleashed in Hamburg and in Dresden, just...
Dresden towards the end of the war, and they tried to burn Berlin about 12, 14 times. This is a very... It's a complicated and knotty story. You keep, depending on how far you crank it back. If you go back to World War One, the Germans bombed a couple of English cities, Hull, and with from Zeppelins. And once that happened, during the interwar years, the promoters of air power... said, you know what, we have to, if we can go in and bomb the enemy next time so much, they will relent. We won't have that many soldiers come in. So air power was oversold. That didn't happen. What the British wanted to do was to bomb the Germans out of their house and then therefore stop wartime production, disorganize the economy. And they had it was a cabinet level paper. It was an official policy called de-housing. So we've always learned that, you know, you go in to bomb the ball bearing factory and you hit some houses. Well, actually, they were aiming for houses, and they developed a particular bomb. It's called the fire bomb, which weighs about, in some versions, 4.5 pounds, 6 pounds, really light. And it's designed to hit the roof, kind of land in the rafters and start a fire. And it was developed by fire engineers and chemists in the United States and in England. And we built different doom towns, different models of Japanese and German cities, and test bombed them in the Utah desert and also, I think, in the south of England, and to see how could you start the best fires. The entire policy didn't work. Many Germans were bombed out of their houses, which is some phenomenal amount. German wartime production just increased steadily up until the last part of the war because it was just so much excess industrial capacity, apparently, and slave labor. And it's horrific. It's just horrific on a lot of levels. Obviously, the Allies were fighting against an enemy that was going to fight to the end. And, you know, it's very hard for a democracy. A democracy gets pulled into this and has to do things it doesn't want to do. Mm-hmm. I got into this whole thing in the book, not from the bombing end almost, but from the rubble end. I was reading three... In an order, I was reading three writers who I think are the most profound writers about dwelling. this fellow, Max Picard, who's a philosopher in Switzerland, no one's heard of, wrote this wonderful book called The World of Silence. And the book is like a found object. It's just an amazing description of silence. And then Gaston Bachelard, who some people know through his wonderful book, The Poetics of Space, which he says, a good house is a daydreaming space. It's a place where we can, for reverie. And he wrote that book at the same time that Picard was writing The World of Silence. And then Heidegger, the famous philosopher in Germany, wrote this essay, Dwelling, Being, Thinking, I think. And I realized, oh my God, all these three guys, all these three philosophers are writing exactly when Europe is in, when Western civilization is in ruins. And all of them, I think, are trying to say, how do you make a house sacred again? How do we make it safe to dwell again? How do we do that? And each, I think, has their own answer. You know, silence, dreams, or just this Heidegger's idea about being and letting the place be and letting the place have some kind of presence at that spot. Hmm. And that all, I think, comes right out of the war, because they're all writing when Europe's in rumble. And that's all, I think, in part, a result of the ferocious war that was fought in Europe and Japan as well. Because you go to Europe today, it's just everything's restored and looks wonderful. It's very hard to imagine and to get our minds back to how extensive that devastation was.
Then you talk about a Frank Lloyd Wright house in Connecticut, which I loved. I went online to look at it. I love Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture. Tell us a little bit about his vision, how he saw dwelling.
Okay, yeah. We're talking about the Zimmerman House, which is in Manchester, New Hampshire. Oh. And it's owned by the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester. It's a wonderful house. If you come up and visit it, or come by and visit it if you're in the area, it's been beautifully curated. It's not a very big house. It's sort of like a larger version of his Usonian house, which he said would be a house for everybody. But the house is a complete object. Everything is designed in it, from the silverware to all the finishes, and it's done. And furniture, you live in it. It's not like when you live in this house, you're going to be thinking one day about adding a wing or updating the furniture, adding granite countertops. It's finished. It's surprising. It's on a corner lot in a city, yet once you walk into the house, it opens up to this backyard that it seems like it's acres and acres deep, and the outside seems to be part of the inside, and it's very liberating to me, and a beautiful object. And the Zimmermans, who lived there, were happy there, really enjoyed the house. And the house, they weren't like slaves to some kind of Frank Lloyd Wright vision. The house freed them to live their life. I say all that defensively because there's a huge division of a feeling about people who go to visit this house. Some people love it, and a lot of people hate it. They feel controlled by Frank Lloyd Wright's vision. They feel closed in. They just want to get out. Some of the rooms are small by modern standards. So strong reaction. And I think that reaction is that, you know, no home improvement. Their house is finished. You know, go live your life. And I think people kind of have a reaction to that. What do you mean we can't just, you know, go get a new carpet? Or what do you mean we're never going to build a wing here? You know, what do you mean we're done? I think that's the reaction to that house.
Howard Mansfield talking with us in 2013 about his book Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.